Welcome to Sports Connections with David Smale, a podcast that brings fun and interesting connections throughout sports. As an author and sports journalist, David has been interviewing fascinating people in sports for more than 40 years. Now here's your host, David Smale.
Things were bleak for Kansas State football as the 1980s drew near their end. The Wildcats were in the midst of a 29-game winless streak. When the Wildcats won their 299th game all time, they had lost a total of 499 games. The hope was that they would win number 300 before losing number 500. That didn't happen. When they finally won their 300th game, they had lost 528 games. Insert your own joke here. Among my favorites as a K-State fan, if you got caught speeding along Kimball Avenue, which borders the north end of the stadium, you didn't get a speeding ticket. You got a football ticket. And if you got caught twice, they'd make you go. And then when the Big Eight Conference used to print the preseason ballots to send to voters, they already had K-State printed in eighth because that's where everybody would put them. Things were so bad that K-State administrators reportedly were considering dropping football to Division II or dropping football altogether. They felt they had one more chance to make it right. The university needed to find a coach who could do what no other coach in the previous 50 years had done, and that was win. That was the task facing athletic director Steve Miller. It's safe to say he passed that test, and we'll get into that more next with Steve Miller. Steve, welcome to Sports Connections.
Thanks, David. It's great to see you after all these years, and I appreciate you asking me to come on the podcast.
Well, it's a pleasure to catch up with you. Why don't you start just giving us a little bit of a tour of your athletic career? I know you coached, you were an administrator, you've worked in the business side of things. Just tell us a little bit about what your career has, where your career has taken you.
Well, it's been a journey of a lot of twists and turns. I started out as a high school track coach at Bloom Township High School in Chicago Heights, Illinois. I was there for 10 years. And then in my ninth year, I was selected as National Coach of the Year in track and field. And as a result, the government had asked me if I would be willing to go to Africa with five other coaches to do some coaching and training. And I did. We went to Nigeria, Kenya, and the Ivory Coast. And one of the coaches on the trip was Steve Simmons, who was the head coach at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo. And he was leaving to go to Oregon State and wanted to know if I was interested in Cal Poly. And I said, well, show me the way. Yeah. And subsequently, the next year, I interviewed, got that job, left Bloom, which was a fabulous place to be, and multiple state championships and lots of great athletes. Went to Cal Poly, was there for 5 years. We won five national championships in track and cross country. I went from Cal Poly to Kansas State University. And I'd been at Kansas State previously for a period of time, and went back to Kansas State as the director of athletics. And during that period of time, when I went to Kansas State, it was we were in the doldrums. Our football team had I think at the time, Sports Illustrated had a cover story and actually called us the worst football program in America, which is I've kept that cover. And I peek at it every once in a while.
Sure.
And we were kind of okay in basketball. We were coming around a bit. Jack Hartman was still there. And the long and short is that Kansas State basketball picked up a little bit. And we can talk about that in a bit. And I inherited a football program that the Kansas State followers inherited a program that was just not very good. And I went on the search for a new coach and literally interviewed 20 people. And each time that I interviewed a person, and they were assistants at high level schools, they were some Division II head coaches. In fact, Mike Price was one of them who ended up saying he was going to come to Kansas State and ended up getting the job at Alabama. And interestingly enough, that job lasted about 3 weeks. Apparently, right. He was caught in some scandal of sorts. After turning down, literally after interviews that are stories unto themselves, somebody, Chris Peterson, who was one of my assistants, said that the University of Iowa had had a great record in the past 10 years. And there's a guy there named Bill Snyder, who was the offensive coordinator. And I looked up Bill's credentials, didn't know him, and contacted him. He didn't apply for the job, and went out to see him and met him. By the way, on that same staff was Barry Alvarez, who mm-hmm. went on to Wisconsin. He was the defense coordinator. Bill was the offensive coordinator. I called some of Bill's former players, and at the time he had three quarterbacks in the NFL, and I called two of them, and one of them said, "Coach Snyder is the absolute best, but I just want you to know that when you make a reception for Coach Snyder and you come to the sidelines, he wants to know why the ball wasn't between the 7 and the 8, as opposed to a little bit on the right shoulder or left shoulder." I said, "This is my kind of guy."
Yes.
And Bill had never been a head coach in college. And he was from the Kansas City, Missouri, Kansas side. Soft-spoken, absolutely knew what he wanted to do. I met him when I left his house. I told, I was with Jim Epps at the time. I mm-hmm. told Jim, I said, "That's our guy." And what ended up happening is Bill asked me a bunch of questions because he was interviewing me. And all I kept on doing is saying, yes, I had no idea if we could do any of the things that Bill wanted, but I desperately wanted him. And he accepted the job. He came in, and even though we did have a committee, the truth is that I did it pretty much on myself. And President Weifold was very accommodating, and he agreed. And we hired Bill, and the rest is kind of history. And I think I knew he was the right guy because he fit our mold as far as understood Western Kansas, understood Kansas City, soft-spoken, but very, very specific about what he wanted to accomplish, and looked unrattled to me. He looked mm-hmm. like a guy just would never get rattled. And after having been at Kansas State for a few years, I realized that he was the type of guy we wanted from a quality person standpoint, and also clearly from an X and O standpoint, certainly on offense. His teams every year had a 1,000-yard rusher and a 1,000-yard pass receiver. And I talked to Bo Schembechler, who was alive at that time, and called him, and I can't quote him because the quote would probably not play well on your podcast, but what he said to me was, "Get him the F out of the Big Ten." So I said, "Fine, he's our guy." So that was the story, and that's the, you may have heard a million other stories, but that's the truth. That's the truth of what happened.
That's a lot of what I'd heard, but there's some things that maybe I haven't heard, and certainly that not all of our viewers or listeners have heard. What were some of the things that he demanded that you just said yes, even though you had no idea how you were going to pull them off?
Well, he first of all wanted to get facilities for everybody but himself. He was interested in building new offices, et cetera, et cetera. But one of his big demands was that he wanted his assistant coaches to be paid commensurate with assistant coaches in the league. And even though we were not going to go to the Nebraska level right. or to the Oklahoma level, we could squeeze out going to a mid-level of that, and we were able to do that. He wanted to change the locker room, and he wanted to change our medical facility. Then later, he wanted to paint the stadium. He knew we weren't going to build yet, and he wanted a new press box. So fortunately, at that time, Jack Vanier, who was a great friend of myself in Kansas State, I went to see Jack, and Jack said, "How much do you need to do all this?" And I gave him a number, and Jack and I literally shook hands, and Jack said, "I'll give you that money if you can't raise it." And what ended up happening is after I started telling the story to people in Manhattan and in the state, people started making contributions. And Jack, interestingly enough, in that round of contributions, Jack said that he would give us $32 million.
Wow.
That was the deal. And Jack ended up giving us money one time, and it was just a guarantee against the building of the facility. And the builder of the facility, talking about the press box, was a Kansas State alumnus and an architect in the city. And he started the project for zero money. We had no money, and Jack guaranteed it. And then ultimately we raised the money. I brought Ernie Barrett back to Kansas State.
Great.
And said, Ernie, you can talk to the adults and I'll talk to the kids, and we'll figure this out. And Ernie was an unbelievable help. And we raised over $32 million and began the process. And the last thing we did in terms of rebuilding and transforming the facility was building Bill's office. Mm. Bill remained in this cubbyhole of an office for years, or not years, but for a year or two. At one point, just to clarify one story that people have heard, and I just want to give it the honor that it's worth, is that we were running short of money. I didn't know. I was kind of embarrassed going back to Jack over and over again. And even though he wasn't giving money, he was giving guarantees.
Right.
So Bill came into my office one Friday night before the Big Eight meetings and gave me his paycheck and said, here, why don't you use this? And at the time, that check was $80,000. And I said, I can't do that, Bill. I can't take this. And I didn't. But that was the kind of guy Bill was. And Bill did things that were really interesting. I think the other issue was Bill convinced me that we should get out of the games that we were playing at that time, non-conference games. I remember us opening the season, I think in his second year, against University of Washington. And mm-hmm. I was coming up the elevator from the ground floor to the press box or to the AD's box. And I think that ride took, I don't know how long, let's just say 30 seconds. And maybe I waited a while and then found the box. And by the time I sat down, we were down 14-0. So it was, you know, we played Washington, we played Arizona State. And Bill said, look, we need to change the schedule and get some wins, at least so these kids have the feeling of what it's like to walk off the field having won. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to care that our non-conference schedule is against, you know, State Teachers College or whoever.
Right.
And Bill was right. We started winning. And then, of course, the obvious happened. After I left, I think he won 6 or 7 games. And then, of course, the fans forgot about the years of misery. And now 6 or 7 was the standard. And then 8 became the standard, and then 9. And I remember the AD at the University of Colorado at the time saying to me, getting to number 1 is not as complicated as people think. Staying there is really a problem. And he, in more prophetic words, were never spoken.
True. Going back, just you told some great detail. And I want to just mention a couple of things that I remember. Because I was in Manhattan at that time, as you remember. And one of the things that you did that was one of Coach Snyder's big objectives was fixing the weight room. And in a book that I wrote, we had a picture of the weight room before he got there. And it looks like a glorified broom closet. It was long and narrow, and you had room for machines on either side of the hall. But if somebody was working on both of them, you couldn't walk through. And now, you know, shortly thereafter, they had a great weight room. How important was that to Bill?
Yeah, it's 100% because of Bill. The one thing about Bill as it relates to the weight room and other things is he had a great insight to the little things that made a difference. Mm-hmm. I think that people look at wins and losses and they don't always know exactly what went into it. They don't know all the little peccadillos, the little small side right. issues. And Bill, as you know, David, was meticulous. I mean, meticulous down to the, if it's not boring and it's not out of the picture, I'll tell you an interesting story, a very quick story. first game away, we played Arizona State in his first year. And it was our opening game. And I went to dinner with the team on Friday night, and they served the team. We were in kind of a hall, and they were serving the team. And butter dishes came out, and Bill picked up a butter pad and pointed to it. I was sitting next to him, and he pointed to it, and he said, butter. And I said, yeah, Bill, that's butter. That's what that is. You know, I was not sure where he was going.
Yeah.
And the bottom line was he was concerned that the butter was salted and not plain. And he was incensed. And I put my head in my hands and I said, I don't know how long I can do this. This is hard. This is hard. But he brought me and all of us to a place that we recognized that it wasn't the on-field product was a example and an offshoot of all the things he did off the field. And that was what made him a great coach. That's because it was 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
That first book that I did with him, we called it The Greatest Turnaround in College Football History, which was his title that he had mentioned in the press conference when he was hired. And he told me in that book that he did not want a top 25 program, or excuse me, a top 25 team. He wanted a top 25 program. The difference being it was sustainable and sustained. And the fact that all of those details that you talked about were the reason that they were the byproduct, not the only goal.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, everything from, you know, his list of things that one needs to think about and the things he did daily, the way he got young people to understand that every day, every part of your day was part of you getting better. And if you weren't getting better, then you were either stagnating or going backwards. Mm-hmm. Bill understood the entire operation. And I think that in our conversation in Iowa City, I think that that you could tell that, you know, mm-hmm. he was everything from being neat to really thinking about what he said. And he had a great passion for the people that he had coached. And when I had talked to some of his former players, they said the same thing. They said he was hard, but fair, meticulous. You were never surprised mm-hmm. when he prepared you for a game. It was always, the preparation was, you know, just absolutely perfect. And he was, I give him a lot of credit. And I will tell you that the winning and losing was a byproduct of everything else he did.
All right, I'm going to put you on the spot, Steve. I've heard you say, and you even kind of hinted to it now, that you were confident that he would be the guy, that he would be successful. But did you really think he could turn K-State into a top 20 program, compete for a national championship 10 years in and maintain that? Did you really think what now is the legacy of Bill Snyder was possible?
Yeah, that's actually a great question, David. And I'm going to answer it a little differently than the normal answer would be. I think of myself as a relatively reasonable person, and I don't make knee-jerk responses, and I kind of get through things, you know, in some level of organization. And I think that was another reason Bill and I got along. Mm-hmm. But I took the job at Kansas State. I know this is maybe a little bit of a strange answer, but I took the job at Kansas State because of John Wooden. One of the reasons that I understood about John Wooden was you never wanted to follow him.
Right.
So no matter who followed John Wooden, it was a losing proposition. So the bar at Kansas State was so low that I felt that if we just did a reasonable job, we were going to be successful. Mm-hmm. So my goal and objective was really to get to 5, 6, 7 wins. And maybe on an off year or on an on year, we may get to 8 or 9 wins, get to a minor bowl game. And really, that's really where I was. And Bill, over a period of time, said, we can be better. Even though we're not going to talk about it, we can be better. So one of the things that happened to me as an individual was that I didn't want to be the coach in the locker room in front of my team and saying, you know, we've got a good team. If we really work hard, we're going to win 7 games and then go 7-0 and then say, we've got 4 games left. What do we do now? Lose them? So at the end of the day, Bill's aspirations, while close to his vest, were much higher than mine. Mine were just getting over the bar. And if I could get over the bar, I could keep my job for a long time, appear to have done a good job. But no matter what you did at UCLA, you were not going to be John Wooden.
Right.
And as a result, if you follow sports, which I know you do, each person successively failed. They just one after another failed, not because they didn't win 20 games, but because they never could reach the level that Wooden had them. So it was an interesting experience, but he dragged me along with everybody else. Bill did. So I thank him for that to this day.
Okay. Before we leave your K-State days, I want to mention one other thing that you did that may have slipped under the radar for some people, but not for me. You allowed an unknown author to write a book about K-State's basketball program in 1988. That's how I got into book writing. I've now published 22 books. And so I just want to say thank you for that before we move on to the rest of your career.
Well, I will tell you this, David. First of all, I did not know your skill level, and I wasn't, 100% sure of what your abilities were. And Kenny Mossman, assured me that you had a real eye for this and a real talent. But it was a combination of the fact that you and I spoke. I enjoyed our conversation, albeit that it was not, extraordinarily long. But more importantly, Kansas State needed to get recognition for whatever it had done. And one of the things I think Kansans in general and certainly K-Staters were not about bluster and not about, saying that we were this or we were that. And I felt that your book would get, great visibility, make people feel better about themselves, talk about a history that had not been talked about. So I looked at it as not a risk. I looked at it as a real opportunity. And then of course you proved me right, which by the way, has been the hallmark of most of my career. I've made great guesses about people, not great guesses about me, but great guesses about people, because those people have proven to be everything I was hoping they would be, plus a lot more, which made me look better. And some of it was kind of, I fell into, so I was and am thankful for the people I've met, and I've watched your career, David, and you've been extraordinary. And I was just happy to be there at the beginning, at the form, at the formulation period, at the time you were forming your goals and objectives. So congratulations really is to you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. All right, let's move on. You left K-State and headed to Nike. Talk about your years at Nike.
Well, I went to K-State and I was the track coach, as you know, and then the AD brought in Dana Altman. Obviously, Bill came in. And 3 years later, I was made an offer by Phil Knight, who I had known for years through my track and field connections. Mm-hmm. And Phil asked me to come to Nike to run a global track and field, which was the start of their programs and start of their business. And for a year, I didn't do it. And then one day, this beautiful, jet stream jet flies into Manhattan, Kansas. And Phil said, just come to the campus, which they called Nike, the campus, and just come and let's talk. And I did. And he made me an offer that was, I don't know how to put it in perspective, but it was really a good offer.
It was more than athletic administrators made at the time.
What is that? I'm sorry.
I said it was more than athletic administrators made at the time.
Yes, it was. It was a lot. It was a lot. And so he made the offer. I delayed again months. And the big reason I delayed had nothing to do with money. It really had, or negotiation. It had to do with Dana and Bill. And I didn't want to leave those guys. And I know the promises we had. And I also could feel, I also felt as if we were on the precipice of real change. And for me, you know, I'm a big believer in, you know, staying to your word and so forth and so on. And in addition to that, the three hardest conversations I had when I left were with Bill, Dana, and Jack Vanier. They were the conversations that were very, very, very hard. But I made the change. And of course, it didn't stop Bill from doing what he did. And Dana went through some changes. Dana left and the program just kept on getting better and better, et cetera. So went to Nike, was the head of global track and field, global athletics for a year. And the second year I was there, the Olympic trials were in Baton Rouge. And I got a call from Phil Knight. And he said, I'm coming down to Baton Rouge. I want to talk to you. And I thought he was coming down to fire me because my budget was overspent. And I thought, you know, I guess I'm out. And that was a nice run. And maybe Kansas State will take me back. And Phil and I had breakfast. And Phil said, I want you to be the head of global sports marketing. And I said, Phil, I don't think I can do that. There were sports I didn't know anything about. And I had not had a history in soccer and a history in golf and so forth. And he said, no, you can do it. You're, you know, good with people. You're not afraid to make decisions. So I took over the job as the head of global sports marketing, ran the largest sports marketing budget in the world. We were over $1 billion. Wow. in available money to identify athletes and governing bodies and countries and so forth and so on. Traveled around the world quite a bit, did a lot in the old Russia and a lot in the old East Germany and made connections, spent time in Africa. I truly became a person that was a citizen of the world. It was a global company. And from the time I was there to the time I left, which was 10 years later, we went from a $8 billion company to a $21 billion company, not wow. because of me, but because of the people that were there and me being part of it. I learned a ton of things about business, was surrounded by a lot of really great people, of which one of them was John Capriati, who I brought in as yeah. my assistant in track and field. And when I took over global sports marketing, I made John the head of track and field. And he just left Nike after 30 years of being there. And of course left Kansas State under, you know, in through the underground, but nevertheless left Kansas State. And the opportunity at Nike was interesting. I was obviously involved in big business. During the time I was there, we signed Brazil to a program that was $200 million a year.
Wow.
Because we made that kind of money in licensing alone coming back. Signed Tiger Woods, was involved in the first signing of Michael Jordan in the 80s when I was a track coach before I went to Nike. And then, you know, Monica Seles, Pete Sampras, Andre Agassi, you know, we started the all school deals. And I was involved in signing, you know, Penn State, Florida, Texas, et cetera, et cetera. Interestingly enough, Nike's, I don't think a lot of people know this. In fact, I'm sure they don't. But when I left Kansas State, President Weifold and Bob Krause sued Nike. But they had a thought in mind, and I assisted them with that. And out of that suit came the Nike deal for Kansas State, which is still in effect today. So the settlement was, you'll take care of all of our sports, you'll put money into our program. So my 10 years at Nike and the 10 years previous to that where I served on their board was, you know, an incredible educational experience. I got to see sports from all levels. And frankly, David, I don't know, maybe before I die, you and I can have a conversation and I can tell you stories that would curl whatever hair you have left. I mean, it would be, I've seen some things, done some things that people read about. It was interesting.
Yeah, there's not much left. It's getting thinner and thinner and receding a bit, but I would love to do that. And I would love to make this conversation go on for hours, but then people would eventually drop off and we don't want to do that. So you mentioned, well, let me do one thing. Let me tell you my favorite Capriati story before we move on to something else. We were promoting one of our books and we were at a Capbackers golf tournament somewhere, and they had John come up and speak, and he was talking about his foursome, and they were all complaining that they didn't get a celebrity with them. And he goes, wait a minute, I'm a coach at Kansas State. Oh, okay. And John, being very humble, I don't know if it's false humility or not, but he said he came across as a humble guy. They didn't ask him what sport he coached. And so he tees off the first hole and they say, well, we know he's not the golf coach. And so then, you know, they didn't play his shot. So he picked up his ball and threw it up to where the good golfers were going to hit from. And it said, well, we know he's not the baseball coach. He said, but what really bothered me is after I threw it, I ran to catch up to the carts. And they said, well, we know he's not the track coach. And that's the Capriati that I know you know far better than I do, but a great guy and a good sense of humor and stuff.
Wonderful guy. He and I have been together 51 years.
Wow. Tell him I said hi next time you talk to him.
I will do that.
One of the names you mentioned briefly, and I'm going to transition from after Nike. I know you went to Oregon as an adjunct professor, but I want to talk about your work with the Agassi Graff Foundation, and give me the correct name of that. I know it was started with Andre, and Steffi Graf joined him. Just talk about what you guys are doing, because I think that is, you know, so sports personalities don't get the credit often for the good that they do. They get credit for being able to hit a ball, throw a ball, whatever. They don't get credit for the good they do in society. So talk about what this foundation is doing.
Yeah, we have a foundation called the Andre Agassi Foundation for Education. And we have had the foundation, interestingly enough, since 1993, when Andre was still playing. And he wanted to start an educational foundation because he left school as an eighth grader. He did not graduate from high school, didn't go to high school. And as a result, always felt, you know, underprepared academically, and knew that the city of Las Vegas had sections of the city which were disconnected from the mainstream of education. And Andre had the idea to build a charter school there. And we raised $40 million through a bond and also some giving, and built a charter school, which, as you know, is it's a public school, but it's a charter school in the sense that we pay for all of the students, all their tuition, their books, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, the rules and regulations are a little bit more stern. Kids wear a uniform. We don't provide tenure for teachers. You have to earn your spot every year. And we had a school K through 12 that had 1,200 children in it.
Wow.
And a 3,000 person waiting list. And we educated those kids on an annual basis. And by the way, you got into the school through simply pulling your name out of a hat. There was no entrance exam. The only issue that had to be true is that you had to be someone who qualified for free lunch. You had to be someone who lived in an area that we call, you know, whatever the name is that one assigns to those areas. But, you know, they were below the poverty level. They were children that had full homes or broken homes. Anyhow, we did that for 16 years or 15 years. And then all of a sudden realized that we were good at education, but we wanted to turn the education over to somebody who really had that skill set. And we partnered with a group out of New York called Democracy Prep, which has charter schools in now Las Vegas, Baton Rouge, New York, Washington, D.C., and what we ended up doing was getting together with charter school operators throughout the country. that were facility poor. In other words, their schools were in the top of a bowling alley, maybe in a church, maybe as an addendum to a school. And we started a fund called the Agassiz Facility Fund, and we raised $1.2 billion, with a B. And we had Merrill Lynch put in $100 million, Citibank put in $50 million, Boeing put in $25 million, University of Michigan, even Catholic Charities gave to us. And we used the money to give $10 million grants to those charter schools that fit a particular diligent mode, educating children, understanding fiduciary responsibility, following those kids through college, et cetera. And we have now, as of 2020, the end of 2020, have built 121 schools nationally. And our goal is to build 200 schools. And we pay for those schools completely. And then at the conclusion of 3 years, the business proposition comes in where the school, once it's fully attended and is receiving state money, they buy the school from us. Mm-hmm. We charge them a 2-3% incremental increase over what they, you know, what it would cost. And at the end of the day, we are able to return a very small return to our investors, but those investors get a double bottom line outcome. They've made some money on their money instead of it being philanthropic entirely, and have engaged in social change. And that model, we went to Arne Duncan when he was the Secretary of Education. We met with the Obamas. We talked about what our plan was. They, you know, kind of gave us the pontific, you know, approval. Right. And we've built 121 schools and are continuing to build schools all over the country. And we now are involved in a technology business called Square Panda, which we've developed technology to help children preschool through third grade enhance their reading skills. We do it in 20 languages. We do it all over the world. And we've continued that along with running a for-profit business. We have the nonprofit side. And for me, as a 77-year-old, you know, old guy that's seen a lot, it's a blessing in my life to be able to combine sports and education and do the things we're doing. So I'm in a great place and feel great about the opportunity to serve others.
I think you just answered my next question. I was going to say, you know, with all that you've done, successful coach, successful administrator, obviously near and dear to my heart because you brought my school, Bill Snyder, but you've done so much. What is your legacy? Would it be what you've done with Andre Agassi and basically fueling the next generation?
Well, I'll finish with a very short story. I got a phone call about 4 or 5 months ago from a woman named Eileena Beard, who was a WNBA player, played in the league for 17 years. I think she was the most valuable defensive player a couple of times. She's a 6'5" black woman from Shreveport, Louisiana, who went to Duke. And she told me that when she went to Duke, she was ill-prepared for the educational rigors because the place that she graduated from simply did not have the programs that helped children achieve at certain levels. So I never met Elena. I never had spent any time with her at all. She called me out of the clear blue and she said that when she talked to people about putting together foundations and combining them with strategies in business, Steve Miller is the person you should call. Mm. So I have never met Elena. I've been doing Zoom calls with her. We have started a foundation called the 318 Foundation, which is the area code for Shreveport. And we are putting together a mentoring and curriculum program in Shreveport, which we think can be a model in the South and then ultimately in the country. We've got Candace Parker on our board. We've got all kinds of people, Ronnie Lott, et cetera, et cetera. And if there's a legacy to be left, I would like that legacy to say that I combined business with a business acumen with educational, you know, love and passion, and that these programs go on in perpetuity. And you said it earlier on, I want sustainable programs that live way after I'm gone, et cetera. And to me, that's the greatest legacy one can leave. It has nothing to do with the money I've made or the successes or whatever you want to talk about. Mm-hmm. People want to talk about Nike and this and that. And I understand all of that, but these are real legacies because children that are affected today will affect tomorrow. And God knows that our country needs that. So to me, that's the best I can do. And giving back makes me feel good.
That's awesome. And if I were smart, I would probably stop right there. But I'm not smart. So I'm going to change the subject here a little bit.
Sure.
You obviously spent a lot of time with Nike, first on the board and then later as an employee and a high level member of the leadership there. And I want to talk to you about the state of college athletics as it's related to shoe companies. Are you okay with that?
Yeah, no, I'm fine with it. I my non-disclosure is long since passed, so I'm fine with all of that. College athletics, for all the good and all the things that have happened in college sports, had several flaws. And one of those flaws was the disparity between the amount of money that the schools were making and the lack of money that the athletes were making. And you hear all kinds of horror stories. And administrators and leadership in college sports will tell you, well, we're giving you an opportunity for a scholarship. You are, a student athlete, et cetera, et cetera. And that just doesn't play anymore, not with the hundreds of millions of dollars that go into both bowl games, national championships, both in basketball and football. And then you have all the non-revenue sports that don't get the benefit of even what the other sports in their school get. So the connection, of course, for Nike was visibility. We'll give you something for you giving us visibility. We'll give you money. We'll give you facilities, et cetera. And on paper, that sounds like a good trade-off. It sounds as if it makes some sense. But like anything where there's a lot of money involved, problems seep in. They sneak in from time to time.
Well,
and one of the issues that's
anytime
been
people are involved
is play for pay and, getting the best athletes and then giving them product and then hoping when they're young kids, 12, 13, 14 years old, that by the time they go to high school, they love Reebok or they love Puma or they love Nike, et cetera. And then you have the person that sneaks in that starts telling the shoe companies, this is a great kid, you should be on top of him. And then, by the way, if he's a great kid, why don't you help us get him? And then there's an exchange of either money or an exchange of, of attitude or whatever the case is, it becomes seedy and it becomes difficult. And it's still pervasive, no matter what anybody tells you, relative to how it works. It may work in different ways from time to time, but it's still there. And as a result, it's either the shoe company's fault or it's the greed of either parents and or people who find athletes. And a young kid is not in the position generally to make a academic intelligent decision about what is right and what's wrong, and very rarely understands the rules and regulations, certainly as they relate to college sports, which the rule book, as you know, used to be biblical in nature. I mean, it told you all the things you couldn't do. It didn't tell you the things you could do. And extra benefits were a problem, et cetera. So now that the NCAA has passed this likeness and using your name, they're beginning to see some of the light. However, there are still the haves and have-nots in college sports. I think within our lifetime, and it could be as soon as 5 or 10 years and maybe sooner than that, you're going to have a gigantic division of the haves and have-nots. You're going to have these 50 or 60 Power Five schools plus some that are going to start doing their own legislation and start thinking about this differently. I think college sports is fantastic. I think it's a great breeding ground for those athletes that have taken advantage of education, et cetera, et cetera. But it's also a den of difficulty.
Yeah.
I think that the administrators that have administrated college sports for a long time were under the false impression that it was and still is a voluntary amateur activity, and it's anything but. When yeah. you start talking about hundreds of millions and billions of dollars, somebody's going to get their finger in the pie in some way. And I think it's just incredible that some of the older administrators have held on to long thought processes. And I think it has caught up with people. You know, the FBI involved, governments got involved, and I think they're getting to the tip of the iceberg, but the depth is still not there, because there's a lot of coaches in this country that I think people revere for the reason that they win, and not always because of their academic successes or this or that. And people would be disappointed to know the real stories behind some of that. And in the end, even at Kansas State, we made a lot of changes. We got great personalities and really honest, forward-thinking people. But without money, none of that would have happened.
Right.
And even though people don't want to fess up to that, that is the truth. It just is, money was at the seat of it, and you had to have money to allow yourself to do the things you wanted to do. So I think the college problems have seeped down into the high schools, and in a lot of places into grade schools. And it's just the way we've accepted doing business, and we've just got to do better.
All right, I'll wrap up with this, and I appreciate your time. I've had a great time chatting with you. Hopefully we can do that again. Since you've been involved in college athletics for years, I want to get your opinion on something that's on everybody's mind. How many teams should be in the college football playoff, and why?
All right, I'm going to tell you a story. I apologize for this, David, but it's actually an interesting story. Years ago when I was at Nike, and this is in the 90s, we got together with CAA, Creative Artist Agency, one of the biggest agencies in the world, and we said we should do something together. Why don't your senior leadership go and our senior leadership will go? Let's come up with 10 ideas and see if there's a cross purpose. And we came up with, in 1996, the college football playoff. We both had agreed that was the way to go. CAA would do the television and do all the associated benefits with the stadiums, and Nike would do the coaches, the teams, and the finances. We offered at that time 108 Division I schools for them to get involved in a playoff, which was an 8-team playoff at the time. But we also went to a 16-team playoff because we wanted to honor the bowl system and use the bowl system to get to a national championship. And we offered 108 schools. We offered each one of them $1 million to participate, whether they went or not, and then offered to pay each of the schools that were in the bowl games their past bowl payout. And then the final four schools, we offered them at the time $12 million because we thought that was the number that we could get from TV ratings, license sales, et cetera, et cetera. We went to the coaches. I went to the coaches of all the Nike schools. CAA went to the coaches and some of the conference officials. Everybody bought in. The only school that didn't buy in, by the way, at the time was the University of Michigan, and that's another story. But nevertheless, they all bought in. I went to the commissioners, and then we went to the presidents, and every school bought in to the idea of a playoff in 1990. It happened during 96 and 98. And then when it went to the president's council for the NCAA, Phil Knight, and at the time, the head of CAA was Michael Ovitz. They insisted on making the presentation. We told them they shouldn't. They did. When those two men walked into that room with the president's council, it was like the devil coming in and invading heaven. And the president's council said, no, we don't need a playoff. Nobody can play 13, 14 games. It's impossible. By the way, it's the same time baseball was playing 50 or 60 games. So at the end of the day, they turned it down. And years later, our proposal in 1990, finalized in 1998, proved to be prophetic. And at the end of the day, I think what they should be doing is bringing the best teams to the bowl games and using the bowls as ways to advance. So from my perspective, and I'm talking about the top bowl games, right, maybe the top 6, 8, I'd have to go through the math in my mind, but bringing 4 schools to the finals, especially during this pandemic, shows you the inequity of what the playoff is all about. I mean, Ohio State's a good team. Northwestern made them look reasonable. And at the end of the day, a team that wins 6 games, how can they play for a national championship? It makes no sense. Even if they're the best team in the country, it just makes no sense. So I really feel that the bowl, I think the idea is spectacular, but I think they're shortchanging schools like Cincinnati, schools mm-hmm. that will never have an opportunity to get in.
Yeah.
And I think it's a short-sighted way to look at a great opportunity.
Here's my plan, and I've been championing this since it was the BCS with 2 teams. If you've got 5 Power 5 conferences, you take your champion of your 5 Power 5 conferences automatically, unless they're not in the top, pick a number, top 12, top 16 right. in the rankings. So those 5 get in, and you take your next 3 at-larges. So this year, your at-larges are Notre Dame, Cincinnati, and Texas A&M.
Right.
And there you have
changes
it.
Changes so the dynamics enormously, and it would be something that I think people could get behind. And I do think, by the way, it's inevitable.
Yeah.
I really do. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah, I do too. Well, Steve, this has been a real pleasure. When I asked different people to be involved and you, and I got a hold of you finally, and you said, yes, it made my day. I've loved every minute of this, and I look forward to the opportunity of doing it again.
At any time, David, and congratulations on what you're doing. And I'm here, I'm not going anywhere. And at 77, I got a lot of free time. So you can get a hold of me at any time. I'm happy to be available. All right.
Thank you
All
very
my
much.
Best, David.
Thanks for listening to Sports Connections with David Smale. Make sure to subscribe, follow, and rate the show from your favorite podcast platform. You can learn more about David Smale and his work by visiting davidsmalebooks.com. Don't forget to join us weekly for new episodes. Until next time.